Hello, you're very welcome to Long Reads, a Jacobin podcast where we look in depth at political topics and thinkers. My name's Daniel Finn. I'm the features editor here at Jacobin, and I'll be presenting the show. When a garage punk band called The Other Half released this song in the 1960s, they meant it as a euphemism for drug pushing. After the opioid epidemic in the US, the mainstream pharmaceutical industry has acquired a reputation that's in the same ballpark as Mexican drug cartels. From the HIV/AIDS crisis to the COVID-19 pandemic, pharmaceutical corporations have also been accused of profiteering at the expense of countless lives. Our guest today is Nick Dearden. He's the director of Global Justice Now and the author of a new book called Pharmanomics: How Big Pharma Destroys Public Health. So the term big pharma has been normalized as a shorthand. It's used very often in the media and in public discourse in the same way as big oil or big tech. But to get down to more specific details, what particular corporate actors do you have in mind when you talk about big pharma, and how did they reach their current position of market hegemony on a global scale?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the names are, well, they've become more familiar as a result of the pandemic. So Pfizer and AstraZeneca are fairly much household names now. And you've got a bunch of others that people have probably heard of too, like GSK and AbbVie. They're the individual companies. And this sector really kind of grew up after the Second World War. And it was a time when we as citizens were kind of developing new relationships with medicines. There'd been massive breakthroughs, you know, like antibiotics, steroids, and tranquilizers slightly later, that were kind of redefining our relationship as citizens with medicines. And on the back of this, a bunch of corporations that owned the rights to produce those medicines consolidated massive amounts of power. I mean, these companies had already been there before the Second World War, but they merged and they grew bigger, and they got to a market position where they basically controlled the whole chain of a medicine's life through research and development, through manufacturing, through to actually selling the stuff at the end of the day. So huge power. And there was this moment, I think, in the 1950s, 1960s, where people kind of realized all of a sudden we're dependent on these companies that we didn't really know about before. How do we know that what they're doing is safe? Like, why are they charging the prices that they're charging? And there came this moment, which I point out in the book, in the 60s, where we could have regulated these corporations in a fundamentally different way. But the companies fought back. And they fought back with a couple of stories, which I feel still haunt us to this day. And one of the stories is, well, you know, you might not like us. You might think we overcharge you for the medicines that keep you healthy. But imagine a world without us. Imagine a world without medicines. And that's obviously a really frightening thought. And, you know, it still frightens people to this day. And so I think at a basic level, the idea that these companies are producing stuff that keeps us safe, you know, kind of keeps them free from the regulation, which really should have been imposed on them a very long time ago. And they also told a kind of more sophisticated story to decision makers, which is, you know, we represent the cutting edge of technological development, scientific innovation in your society. And, you know, at the time, in the middle of the Cold War, they went to Western decision makers and said, you know, do you really want to threaten that? Do you really want to undermine that? If not, allow us to keep doing what we're doing, because we're on your side and our strength is your strength. And they really won, and they convinced politicians and decision makers, particularly in the United States, but throughout other parts of the Western world too, that essentially what they needed to do was actually extend their rights and power and privilege in the global economy. And so you have a series of changes as the 80s and 90s go on, which gives these corporations massive power on a global level. Now, what's the basis of that power? What do these companies today share in common? Well, I'd argue that you've got a small number of companies here. And by the way, it's getting smaller all the time, right? So the number of companies actually in this field, you know, through mergers and acquisitions is being reduced all the time. The corporate power of individual companies is getting bigger and bigger. But they're not really competing against each other in any normal sense. They're not really competing against each other in terms of the medicines they're producing, because they enjoy literal monopolies over the production of the medicines that they're producing through intellectual property rights, through patents, through trade secrets. And that's become utterly central to the super high profits of this industry. And so I think when you talk about Big Pharma, absolutely key to understanding what Big Pharma is and how its power is exercised is this idea of intellectual property. And they've increasingly developed business models around making their monopolies as deep, as enforceable, as rigid, as expansive, as global as possible, because they've realized, particularly from the 80s and 90s onwards, that's where their money comes from. And in turn, that's changed the way the sector operates. So, you know, when we think back to the 1960s, while some of these companies behaved in absolutely appalling ways in terms of, you know, how they marketed their drugs, sometimes how they tested their drugs, nonetheless, they did do real research and development. That's become much, much less through the 80s and 90s, through the development of a financialized economy in which they realized that their power came not really from researching and developing drugs, not really from manufacturing drugs, not really from having a kind of educated medical staff, but through these monopolies, through the monopoly rights that they enjoyed on certain drugs. And that's changed the way the pharmaceutical industry thinks about its relationship with the rest of society. And when we talk about Big Pharma today, I think it's all wrapped up in this idea that increasingly you've got a bunch of companies here which are literal monopolists and which will sit upon the knowledge that they have usually acquired and absolutely max it out for the good of their shareholders, to extract as much as they can for their shareholders and their investors' bottom line, regardless of what the consequences are for the rest of society.
There are a few questions that arise directly from what you've been saying there about the big picture in terms of Big Pharma. But to begin with, broadly speaking, what implications does the role of these corporations in producing drugs and medicine have for global healthcare?
So I've talked about their addiction to super high profits, which is based on monopolies. And this really is an incredibly profitable industry, three times or so in excess of what the normal profit rate that companies can expect to make, big companies can expect to make. And, you know, I've talked about how that comes out of the fact that they enjoy monopoly privileges, but they don't make these super high profits off just any old monopolies. You know, they're very careful about which drugs they decide they're going to buy the rights to produce. And the drugs that they particularly like relate to treating chronic conditions. I mean, a serious but chronic condition that requires treatment is absolute gold dust to these companies, because, you know, it's not going to cure you. You're going to need to be on this drug, you know, for a very long time, if not the rest of your life. And if that chronic condition is suffered by somebody who, you know, happens to be protected by a health system, then that's great. Or if it's a chronic condition that happens to be suffered by people who are particularly wealthy, that's great, because you can afford to pay, you know, really quite large amounts of money for the rest of your life. You know, the other kind of blockbuster area, if you like, is cancer treatments. Again, you know, the prevalence of cancer as we live longer and so on in richer countries is increasing and increasing. And so that's seen as a particularly lucrative area. And so they specialize in these kind of areas where they think they can make very, very large amounts of money, and they buy up the knowledge and they begin producing drugs and charging, you know, absolutely eye-watering amounts for it. So it is not unusual nowadays to have new drugs coming onto the market which can accrue, you know, something like in America, certainly something like $100,000 per patient, right? That we've seen a few drugs in that kind of category now. So even for rich countries' health systems, this is enormously expensive. That's their ideal. And then what they'll do is they will put, you know, what they call, what has come to be called research and development today, is time and effort spent doing what they call evergreening these drugs. So you've got a monopoly on this drug, but it's going to, you know, it's still going to run out after 20 years. How do you extend that? And they will make, you know, really small tweaks to these drugs. So you're not really making them any more effective. You're not really making them any more pleasant to take for the patient. You're making small changes that you can sell as being an improvement. And then, you know, you reapply for the monopoly because you say it's changed just enough that we deserve another monopoly for this. And you see that time and time and time again. I mean, in researching the book, I mean, it's an extreme example, but the worst example I came across was literally a company that put a powder pill into a plastic capsule, you know, and then you apply for another another monopoly on it, and you've got, you know, several more years through in which time you can continue charging whatever the market will bear. So this obviously is not good for us as patients. It means that the companies that are producing our drugs are not focused on the diseases which kill most people. You've still got diseases in the world like TB and malaria killing enormous amounts of people, but you know, they're very little interest for the big pharma companies, because by and large, the people suffering from those diseases are poorer people in poorer countries. So you're not going to make your super high profits in those circumstances. But I mean, even coming back to the global north, they're not really interested in pathogens that could cause pandemics. I mean, just look, you know, what happened before the COVID pandemic. No big pharma company was looking into coronavirus, even though coronaviruses had already caused epidemics in other parts of the world. There was very, very little done on any pathogen that could cause a future pandemic, despite warnings from the World Health Organization. Just not interested, because it's very unlikely that pathogen is going to cause a pandemic. And so that's just wasted money as far as the pharma companies are concerned. Same with antibiotics. I mean, antibiotic resistance, we know, is growing all the time, partly through overuse, but we haven't really invested as society very much in creating alternatives to antibiotics, even though we think it's perfectly possible. Again, because the pharma industry is not particularly interested in something which is going to be used, you know, as a second or third generation drug. You know, by the time that drug becomes mainstream, you know, the patents are going to have expired. So they're not interested in that. And I think the drugs that we need to be developed for the future, the drugs that we need to be developed to save lives now, are not particularly interesting for the pharmaceutical industry. The drugs that can treat chronic conditions, the drugs that can treat conditions suffered by richer people in richer countries, they are more interesting, because those companies think that they are going to be able to charge vast amounts of money for those drugs. So it massively skews which medicines are being developed. And one of the problems, particularly, I think, is that, I mean, governments kind of get this. Right. I mean, governments for a long time have recognized the pharmaceutical industry is not really doing the job that we want it to do. That's why you've got all manner of first of all, it's why you've got massive public investment in medicines, absolutely enormous, particularly in the United States. It's why you've got a whole bunch of public philanthropic organizations at a global level, because there's a recognition, even from someone like Bill Gates. I mean, he's very, very supportive of the intellectual property system, because that's how he made his money. Even he recognizes, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is not going to solve the diseases of poverty in the world. So he sets up all kinds of philanthropic organizations to try to correct the market's shortcomings in that regard. But at the same time, we are still kind of reliant on them. We're still kind of reliant on these companies. We haven't put anything else into place so that they still ultimately control the pipeline. And that's what you saw in COVID, you know, essentially, where we recognized they couldn't really do the job, but actually we didn't have an alternative, because they still have a chokehold on the production of medicines at a domestic level in Western countries and to some degree at a global level too. So hugely, hugely, hugely problematic. And there was an awful story, actually, a few weeks ago, where they were looking at a drug being developed by GSK. And GSK had taken over this knowledge that had been developed, I think, by the US Army into a TB medicine. And they expressed some interest in it. But then when they controlled it, they've been kind of slow walking this TB development. They're not really very interested in it at all. But they have found that the same knowledge allowed them to make a shingles vaccine, which has been extremely lucrative in Western markets. So they've pushed through the shingles medicine, which has accrued them, you know, a lot of money, but sat on this TB knowledge and done almost nothing with it. So hugely, hugely problematic.
When you want to save humans from disease, ask science.
Perhaps conscious of the image problem for big pharma, Pfizer has taken to running ads that conflate its work as a private corporation with the entire project of modern science.
We believe science can cure every human disease. And we're going all in. Because in the end, science will win.
Last year's Pfizer ad campaign promised to vanquish confusion and hopelessness, as well as strictly medical problems.
Uncertainty, hopelessness, and illness all lose.
To what extent do the major pharmaceutical companies rely on public universities and public research for the products that they develop?
almost all new drugs rely enormously on public funds, particularly at the most risky part of development. I mean, that's the really interesting thing, right? We're told this story about the ingenuity of the private sector, and we're really dependent upon the entrepreneurship of corporations and so on. Actually, what you find when you look at medicines is the complete opposite of that. All of the innovative stuff is done with public money, either at universities or often by small biotech companies. The big pharma companies then essentially privatize, enclose that knowledge, and they then use it in order to produce the drugs that they think are gonna make them the most money, and they enclose that knowledge behind a wall of intellectual property for as long as they can possibly get away with, and charge whatever the market will bear. But it's really interesting when you look at what the pharma companies are actually engaged in research and development on, and often, you know, it's very little. Certainly compared to the past, their research and development budgets have reduced proportionally to their overall spend. And oftentimes, even when they say they're doing research and development, what they're doing is this evergreening, this making small tweaks so that they can extend the monopoly rights to continue producing their drugs into the future, and they can ward off any kind of competition from generic companies, or smaller companies, and maintain their position. So it's hugely dependent upon the public. And the really extraordinary thing, I think, is that the governments who essentially allow that knowledge to be privatized, to be enclosed, don't seem to have kind of got their heads around the fact that by simply handing that knowledge over and giving higher and higher walls of intellectual property to these big pharma companies, you're going to end up with a system that produces not necessarily the most important medicines that you need, but certainly not at a price that you can afford them. To give you one example, you've got this drug called Humira, which is a kind of anti-inflammatory, very, very useful for dealing with rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease. Wasn't invented by AbbVie, but AbbVie essentially bought out the know-how. I mean, they bought out a company that had made the know-how. The public sector had been deeply invested in this drug technology for a long time. AbbVie then spent, you know, a few hundred million, or maybe even a few billion, on supposedly research and development around Humira, but they didn't make the drug any more effective. No more pleasant for patients to take it. And then they increased the price by 470%. So, you know, essentially what it seems that they were doing with that research and development money was working out ways that they could extend and deepen their monopolies on that drug over the long term and create what are called patent thickets. You know, so it's not just one patent that says, you know, you have the right to produce this drug. It's a whole thicket of different patents. And then ended up charging, I mean, that drug at one point in the US was about $77,000 per patient. You know, even here in Britain, the National Health Service had to ration this drug because it was so astronomically expensive. And so the role of the pharmaceutical sector, far from being the innovative bit of medical research and development, is actually purely, almost purely, about monopoly control of the drugs that we increasingly rely upon, because that's the way that they can max out their profits.
Could you give us some notable examples of some of the scandals or controversies that have arisen involving big pharma over the years?
Yeah, so I guess one of the biggest scandals that people are really aware of at the moment, particularly in the US, but I think everywhere, thanks to, you know, some of the Netflix documentaries like Painkiller, is the opioid epidemic. This is a really shocking story where essentially this company called Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family, created an ultra strong painkiller. You know, not that different from heroin, which should have been restricted to the most serious end of life pain, maybe some sorts of cancer pain. Now, prescribed extremely sparingly, essentially. The company then went out and used all of the marketing tools at their disposal to convince medical practitioners across the US that this was something that basically everybody should be taking who was experiencing even the mildest forms of pain. And going out of their way, you know, including, you know, effectively corrupting academics and medical professionals to convince people that it wasn't addictive, when it was clearly extremely addictive.
In a 2015 legal deposition, Richard Sackler of Purdue Pharma disclaimed any responsibility for the opioid epidemic.
Do you believe Purdue's conduct in marketing and promoting OxyContin in Kentucky caused any of the prescription drug addiction problems now plaguing the Commonwealth?
I don't believe so.
Sitting here today, after all you've come to learn as witness, do you believe that Purdue's conduct in Kentucky has led to an excessive or unnecessary amount of opioids being located throughout the Commonwealth of Kentucky?
I don't believe so.
Do you believe that any of Purdue's conduct has led to an increase in people being addicted in the Commonwealth of Kentucky?
No.
The end result of this was a wave of drug addiction and drug dependency that saw 200 to 300,000 people die in the United States over the last two decades. Absolutely horrific public health crisis that I think has really, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is not popular, particularly in the United States anyway, because unlike, you know, in countries like mine, where we're somewhat protected from the prices the pharmaceutical companies are charging by a national health system, you know, clearly in the US, they don't have that. So they already kind of know that these guys are out for massive amounts of profit, whatever the consequences. But the opioid crisis, I think, has really accelerated that dislike and distrust of the pharmaceutical industry and has been incredibly important in some of the changes that you're beginning to see at a federal and state level now in the US.
At the end of last year, the US Supreme Court heard a challenge to a bankruptcy plan for Purdue Pharma. CBS had this report.
They need to be held accountable. What they've done is really wrong. It's totally wrong.
Ellen Isaac says her son Ryan was a happy teenager who loved baseball and was a master carpenter until he fell and hurt his back.
The doctor immediately said, oh, we've got this new medication. It's non-addictive.
The medication was OxyContin, and it sent Ryan into a lifelong pattern of addiction until a fatal overdose when he was 33.
Do you blame the Sacklers for Ryan's death?
I do. I absolutely do.
She wants the Supreme Court to let her file a civil lawsuit. And along with the Justice Department, she is urging the court to reject a 2021 bankruptcy plan that required Purdue Pharma to pay up to $6 billion to help combat the opioid crisis, including $750 million to victims and their families, in exchange for shielding Purdue's owner, the Sackler family, from thousands of lawsuits, even though they are not bankrupt themselves. The case has divided those families impacted. Most want the court to uphold the bankruptcy plan, writing in court papers it is the only viable mechanism for affording victims the aid they need and need now. Other large organizations that have reached similar bankruptcy agreements to end lawsuits, including the Boy Scouts of America and the Catholic Church, filed briefs supporting the Purdue deal. But Isaacs says justice is about more than money.
Give me the ability to get a jury by trial of my peers and other people to do likewise the same. You know, closing that door, it's not going to help anybody with healing.
That is a terrible, terrible scandal, but it's quite an old-fashioned scandal in that Purdue Pharma did actually invent OxyContin, the painkiller we're talking about. Increasingly, in a world where the pharmaceutical companies don't actually do the research, the basic research and development, don't actually invent the drugs that we're dependent upon. A more modern scandal is actually that involving this guy called Martin Shkreli that people might have heard about. You know, this kind of young guy, he was called the Pharma Bro, he's very into hip hop music. And he'd come from the hedge fund world. He was a financier. You know, and by his own admission, he said he got out of hedge funds because there wasn't enough money to be made, and instead he decided to start a pharmaceutical company because that's where the real money was. He would look for drugs that where there was a monopoly, essentially, like it wasn't necessarily a patent monopoly, but there was effectively a monopoly on the production of those drugs that it would have taken other companies a fair while to break. And he would look at those drugs, he would buy them up, and then he would put up the price as much as he could possibly get away with. And so he bought up this drug that was used to treat a really horrible parasitic infection in people with HIV, sometimes unfortunately affects pregnant women. So a really important drug. He bought it and increased the price by 5,000% overnight, knowing that people had nowhere else to go. They'd have to pay it. And he did some really interesting interviews afterwards. You know, he became this kind of the most hated man in America, managed to unite Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump in their utter dislike of him. But he said, look, you know, I'm getting all this terrible publicity and everything, but actually I'm not doing anything different to what the rest of the pharmaceutical industry is doing, because my job is not to make my investors a bit richer. It is to maximize the profits that I am returning to those investors. And if I have one regret, it is that I didn't increase the price further, because I probably could have done and therefore should have done.
If you could rewind the clock a few months, I wonder if you would do anything differently.
I probably would have raised the price higher, is probably what I would have done.
Why?
I think healthcare prices are inelastic. I could have raised it higher and made more profits for our shareholders, which is my primary duty. And again, no one wants to say it. No one's proud of it. But, you know, this is a capitalist society, capitalist system, and capitalist rules. And my investors expect me to maximize profits, not to minimize them or go half or go 70%, but to go to 100% of the profit curve that we're all taught in MBA class.
Now, Shkreli is, you know, has become a hate figure, almost a pantomime villain, because he does all of this with a smirk on his face and he's quite proud of it. But he's absolutely right. You know, he's extreme. But ultimately, the model that he's employing is not that different to the model that is completely mainstream in the pharmaceutical world at this point.
Martin Shkreli added to his pantomime villain reputation by shelling out $2 million to buy the only copy of an album by the Wu-Tang Clan in 2015. He then played a teaser clip of the album online to celebrate Donald Trump's election victory the following year. The audio version that you're hearing right now doesn't include the sight of Shkreli mugging for the camera as he plays the clip.
Simon Shaolin, the saga continues.
I don't get out. Get that book.
So yeah, that's the intro for any of you guys that like the Wu-Tang Clan.
One member of the group, Ghostface Killa, described Shkreli as a shithead, prompting him to release the following video in response.
Dennis, I'm going to call you by your government name. You're not a Ghostface Killa. I'm sorry. In fact, you know, most people don't ever try to beef with me. Do you know why?
What do you guys think?
They're stupid.
Nobody's that dumb. Every one of my enemies, they try to stay anonymous. They try to stay out because, you know, it's just one of these things where, for whatever reason, you think it's okay to beef with me. But that's a big mistake.
After Shkreli went to jail for fraud, Joe Rogan asked RZA of the Wu-Tang where the album was now. The comedian Donnell Rawlings was part of the conversation and had his own theory about the difference between use value and exchange value in modern music.
Yeah, the reality of it is that it's now sitting in a temperature-controlled room in the Department of Justice.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's his? He owns it still?
Well, he's incarcerated right now.
Right.
And so I think a lot of his assets has been seized by the government, and including that album.
So those songs have never been released?
Nah.
How many songs?
Like 25 songs.
That is ridiculous.
I think, me personally,
that needs to be released.
I think, my personal opinion, nobody in the history of music has been able to make an idea or a song that's never heard. Art. Like,
right.
To be quite honest, it might not even be no motherfucking songs in there.
Yo, don't you think he listens?
Yo, no,
don't
listen.
You think he knows?
The point I'm making is more valuable.
It's legend.
Never being heard.
Ooh.
Never being cracked.
Right.
Then release. You release it, then you set it up for people to be critical of it, kind of give their opinion.
Around the turn of the century, there was a high-profile international campaign around treatments for HIV and AIDS in the global south. Did that have any lasting consequences for the overall context or framework in which Big Pharma has to operate?
Well, this was a really interesting moment because just before the HIV crisis, pharma had convinced governments that their monopoly should be global And so one of the first agreements that was endorsed by the newly formed World Trade Organization was the TRIPS Agreement, which kind of said the intellectual property we enjoy should be the same everywhere in the world as it currently is in the United States. This was absolutely enormous. I mean, bear in mind, most European countries didn't have patents on medicines in the late 1970s. The UK did, Germany did, but a lot of countries didn't. And in fact, that was useful for us. I mean, in the 1960s, Harold Wilson's Labour government overrode patents on antibiotics and imported them from Italy, where they didn't patent medicines because, you know, he could save a lot of money for the National Health Service in that way. In the mid-90s, very few countries in the Global South put patents on medicines, and that was extremely important and useful for them because it meant they didn't have to reinvent the wheel. They could look at what had been done elsewhere, and particularly in India, where there was a good manufacturing industry, they could just start pumping stuff out at a much, much cheaper price. Absolutely vital. That all changed with the passing of TRIPS, which has been called a kind of recolonization of knowledge at a global level. All of a sudden, all of these countries had to start thinking about how they could abide by American levels of intellectual property, respecting the intellectual property that was by and large held by Western corporations. And the HIV/AIDS crisis really came to a head a few years after that. So in South Africa, late 90s, early 2000s, just phenomenal amounts of people were contracting HIV, phenomenal amounts of people were dying of AIDS. And at that time, for those people, HIV was more or less a death sentence, despite the fact we had the drugs that could prevent the transmission of HIV from mother to child and massively extend your life. I mean, extend your life indefinitely. The drugs weren't nice to take, but at least we had them. The problem for people in Southern Africa was they couldn't afford them because it was, something like $10,000 per patient, just simply unaffordable for almost everybody in that context. So the South African government, the ANC government, said, well, we need to look at how we can get around this. They knew that these pills were being made for a dollar a pill in India, generically. But South Africa, because it had adopted the elements of the TRIPS agreement that protected intellectual property, wasn't allowed to do that. So they weren't allowed to import them. So they tried to pass a law so that they could import these medicines. 39 pharmaceutical corporations slapped a lawsuit on them and accused them of piracy, pirating their intellectual property. Now, eventually those corporations backed down, as you said, because there was a huge, as you can imagine, a huge international campaign against this. But nonetheless, I think it sent a chill down the spine of all developing countries who were put off developing their own medicine industry because they didn't want to be in the position that South Africa had been in. And by the way, the pharmaceutical corporations were backed by Clinton's administration, were backed by the European Union at the time. I mean, they were all saying you can't do this, despite the fact that this is going to make an enormous difference to the spread of HIV and make an enormous difference to the amount of people dying and contracting HIV. You just can't do it. So, I mean, South Africa overcame it thanks to international campaigning. But I think that the example that set was a very serious one. And when it comes to COVID, it's one of the reasons that so few countries have managed to develop decent medicines industries that could help get vaccines out to people in a timely way. There were only a few countries like India and China that could do that because essentially they'd ignored, just to one degree or another, these international rules that came in the mid-90s. But it is still, I mean, there is something important here, right? It is still possible for countries to do what South Africa did. And India has always interpreted these intellectual property rules in as relaxed a way as it possibly can, which is incredibly useful. And that's how it became the pharmacy of the developing world. I mean, so many countries are still dependent on Indian medicines, but countries are still doing it. I mean, Colombia took a really brave decision a few months ago and said, again, it was HIV drugs. And they said, we just can't afford these drugs. We can't afford to give them to all of our people. We are going to override these patents and we're going to import from India. And they're still going through a process. I mean, they're getting a lot of pushback, but they're still going through a process of trying to achieve that. And it looks like they're really committed to it. So that would be amazing. But they come under immense pressure, an immense pushback. I mean, the company that they're fighting against, Veev, it's got, and I think this is the other result, this is the other thing that came out of the South African example and the HIV example, is that pharmaceutical companies got much better at PR. Like they realized that all of a sudden, whether they could get away with something or not depended on how the international public felt about it and how civil society felt about it. And so, you know, Veev, which makes the drug that Columbia is effectively trying to override the patent on, you know, it supports pride marches all around the world, and it likes to pretend it's, you know, very, very into gay rights and it's part of the community and whatever. But at the end of the day, it is still making drugs that are utterly unaffordable for many of the people suffering from the disease that those drugs are supposed to deal with.
The controversy about AIDS medication became a plotline in The West Wing. The president of a fictional African country travels to Washington in search of assistance. He receives a cold shoulder from the US pharmaceutical industry.
This isn't about profit.
Sir, you have interrupted me again.
My apologies, Mr. President.
How can you tell us this isn't about profit maximization?
Why do you sell Emprix for half the price in Norway than you do in my country?
I don't think that's the issue.
Let's make it the issue.
Toby.
Let's make it the issue for the moment, please.
You can't compare prices worldwide, Toby.
Sir, excuse me, sir.
Yes.
I was
the one who asked you the question. I'd appreciate it if you directed your answer to me.
A week ago, you people stood up and said that AIDS has only a casual relationship to HIV.
I'm not certain to whom you're referring when you say you people, but it was President Mbeki of South Africa who said that, and not anyone in this room.
In keeping with the general spirit of the show, the West Wing staffers urged the president to capitulate instead of trying to challenge the power of Big Pharma.
I'm going to put a deal together, and I want you to agree to it.
What am I agreeing to?
I can get them to lower their prices. But you have to commit your military, your Customs Bureau, and your Ministry of Health. You have to commit them to stopping the influx of black market HIV drugs from Korea and Pakistan, and from wherever else they're coming.
35.8% of our adult population is infected. 60% of our hospital beds are occupied by people who are HIV positive. Our Institute of Policy Analysis says in the coming decade, 50% of all households in my country will have at least one member infected with HIV. To think I would care about international patent law at a time like this is unrealistic.
Mr. President, the U.S. Department of Commerce will put your country on a watch list. That's the first step toward trade sanctions. Our Congress could end all aid to your country.
Or you can agree to what we're saying,
in exchange for which we believe we can get Congress to forgive the debt on all your past development loans. And we believe the Export-Import Bank will offer $1 billion in loans to finance the purchase of American AIDS medication.
In the last few years, what did the COVID-19 pandemic tell us about Big Pharma, its approach to the production of vaccines, and has the pandemic itself resulted in any notable long-term changes for the pharmaceutical industry?
I think it has, and I think it's quite complex, the way that COVID has affected the industry. So first of all, of course, the industry saw COVID as a great opportunity in some ways, and the head of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, was really honest about that. He said, this is not just an opportunity for us to make money. This is an opportunity for us to change the reputation of this industry. Now, Pfizer, going into the pandemic, was supposedly the least trusted company in the least trusted industry in the United States. And so they saw it as a way of becoming the savior of the world, effectively. And to some degree, they managed that. Right? So there's lots of examples of, in Western countries, Israel, for example, where Pfizer rolled out its drug very, very quickly. You know, there were stories of cocktails being named after its vaccines in bars because they were saying, well, without Pfizer, we wouldn't be here. So in some ways, you know, Pfizer became a household name. But in other ways, I think the results for the industry long term are going to be very different. And one of the reasons for that is COVID really showed people very, very clearly a number of things. One of them is they do not have the best interests of global healthcare at heart. They have their profits at heart. And that was particularly something experienced by Global South countries, who, as a result of the fact that the intellectual property behind the vaccines was being held by a small number of big pharma companies, essentially meant that those companies could dictate who got to produce the drug, and who didn't, what the manufacturers were able to charge for that drug, who got to buy it and who couldn't buy it. And so at a time where frontline health workers in many poorer countries couldn't be vaccinated, you know, well into the pandemic, you know, people in the West like myself had had three or four doses already. And it wasn't simply a case that Pfizer wasn't selling to those countries. That's bad enough. The problem was that by monopolizing the intellectual property, they were telling other countries, they were refusing to share it. They were telling other countries effectively they couldn't make drugs, even though we could have made way more vaccines. I mean, there was a piece of research done in the middle of the pandemic that suggested, you know, there's 100 factories around the world that could have produced mRNA fairly quickly if the technology and know-how had been shared with them. The fact is, it wasn't shared with them. And that was atrociously bad for people in global South countries who couldn't get the vaccines. It obviously cost way more lives than it would otherwise have done. But it was also bad for us, because what that meant was the disease was able to spread for longer. More mutations arose as a result of that. And that meant, you know, we have mutations like Omicron that we didn't need to have, that threatened to override some of the vaccines that were already available. So it made ending the pandemic that much harder. And I think that was, you know, that's been recognized by Global South countries, who felt that the entire approach that they've been told to swallow for the last 30 years, well, when it comes to a crisis, just trust the market. If the market goes wrong for any reason, don't worry, you know, we'll give you some charity to get you through. Well, neither of those things happened. Almost no donations outside the United States. And clearly all the market did was what the market has always done. It sold to where there is money to be made and ignored everybody else. So they've realized that. And I think that's created a real change in how many parts of the global South relate to medicine development. But even in the United States, you know, I think that the Biden administration was kind of horrified by the way, particularly the way that Moderna behaved. Because Moderna's vaccine was supported 100% with public money. Pfizer also got a lot of public money, but it wasn't quite the same proportion. Moderna was seen as the US government vaccine. And yet, when it came to it, Moderna refused to share. Moderna refused to even accept on some of its patents that the US scientists had anything to do with creating those patents. And the tension between the Biden administration and Moderna was absolutely enormous. I mean, there was a court case taken where the government tried to claim its rights over some of the vaccine technology that they had developed. You don't have to be a great philanthropist to understand why that was a concern, because in the middle of the pandemic, it was the case that virtually everybody in Asia, Africa, and Latin America that had got a vaccine had a Chinese vaccine. So that's not great for US soft power, other than to some degree AstraZeneca. The Western vaccines, the mRNA vaccines in particular, were nowhere to be found in the global South. And that's had a long-term impact, I think. If you look at the kind of breakdown of the multilateral system, and we're seeing, you know, obviously we're seeing an acceleration of that because of the horrific events going on in Gaza. But I think a lot of that started with COVID and the idea we are not one multilateral system. We are two worlds. And the way that we dealt with the COVID epidemic was absolute proof of that.
There was an attempt by a group of former global leaders known as the Elders to promote a very different approach to the production of vaccines. The chair of the Elders, Mary Robinson, made the case in a BBC interview in April 2021.
I think we have to think about this pandemic as not being the last pandemic, unfortunately. Because of the way we're living, because of the proximity, the way that humans have encroached on animal life, we're probably going to see other pandemics. So we've learned we need to strengthen health systems globally, something the Elders are very focused on.
But when the pharmaceutical companies say it's not as simple as just get the manufacturing processes in place, these have been built from scratch. There are also concerns from the big pharma companies that there's a safety risk with DIY versions of the vaccines being badly produced, which could undermine confidence in quality or even lead to new mutations.
That was a point that I was making earlier, that we need the technological transfer and voluntary licensing for developing countries to ensure that not only is there scalable, rapid production, but also reliable quality assurance processes. And this is doable. This is absolutely what should be done. There's no excuse.
Robinson seemed reluctant to take the bait when she was asked about the power of big pharma.
What is the block when you're actually in office to doing this? Why are leaders not doing this?
It's a good question. I think the very fact that former leaders, with our experience, are calling and are urging, and I'm glad that there will be a resolution at the World Health Assembly, as you say, that you know there is a mounting pressure for this. It needs a leadership for humanity. It is not tolerable that intellectual property rights and profit should be more important than people's lives and health.
But the point is, you know that while you're also in office. So you say it's a good question. Could you hazard a guess to why? Is it because of the relationships with pharmaceutical companies that you have while you're in office?
I think, you know, there is a powerful lobby there, there's no doubt. But it didn't work with HIV and AIDS, and we benefited hugely. Let's learn the lesson.
As a final question to wrap things up, this really comes in two parts or two separate questions, but perhaps you could address them together. First of all, what wider implications does the status and the role of Big Pharma have for how we address other challenges, for example, the climate crisis? And secondly, is there an alternative model for the production of drugs and medicines and other treatments that we could adopt? And what would be some of the key steps towards setting up such a model on a global scale?
When you look at COVID, it is actually an example that we need to learn from in terms of how we deal with other crises, because as bad as COVID was, the climate crisis is going to be so much worse. And what we saw was that we had a global economy developed in the 1990s in the image of corporate power. It was all about forwarding corporate interests and the right to do whatever you want with your money, you know, whenever you want, wherever you are in the world. That system, that economy fundamentally failed us. And that was really clear, as I've already said, for Global South countries, but to some degree it was clear for all of us. I mean, the immense amount of public money that we put into this at the end of the day went to make an absolute fortune for pharmaceutical corporations. For Moderna, several members of its board became multi-billionaires, including its CEO. And that's because this knowledge that should really be regarded, in my opinion, as a public good, was treated as a private asset. And if that was a problem for COVID, it's going to be an enormous problem when it comes to dealing with climate change, because the climate technologies that all countries on Earth require to deal with climate change, to try and adapt to it and try and mitigate to it, are going to be held by a handful of corporations again. And for most countries in the world, they're going to have to rent at very high cost, in many cases, I imagine, that technology back from those corporations. And that is no way to deal with probably the most serious crisis that humanity has ever faced. So what I'm saying is those rules, treaties, institutions of the global economy, like the World Trade Organization, are not in any way set up to help us deal with the problems that we face as humanity. And we need to begin dismantling them. And I think COVID, you know, one of the things we were campaigning for in the middle of COVID was this idea of a waiver of intellectual property during COVID on vaccines and other forms of treatments and diagnostics. You know, those things should not be treated as private property during a pandemic. But I actually think that was just the beginning of the kind of campaign that we need to be running, which should say, in the middle of a climate emergency, there is no way that the kind of knowledge that can allow us to deal with that climate emergency should be treated as private property for a handful of corporations so that they can make as much as they possibly can, as much as the market will bear, that they're extracting out of that for their shareholders, particularly when, for the climate crisis, just as with COVID, an awful lot of that technology has been made with massive public investment. You know, public investment is so important in virtually all of the technologies that we rely on in modern society. So beginning to dismantle that is really important. Now, yeah, I spent a lot of my life campaigning against the World Trade Organization, campaigning against international trade agreements, campaigning against the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And that's really because I think from that period in the 90s, when the global economy was being invented, we had a chance of stopping some of it. And we did stop some of it, but nowhere near enough. I think it's very unlikely, and my experience of campaigning in COVID shows to me, it's very unlikely that's going to be unwound through international negotiations at a global level. There are just too many vested interests to overcome. I think it's going to be unwound, at least at the start, at a national level, where countries simply begin ignoring the way that this system works. And what does that look like when it comes to medical research and development? Well, there's a great example in South Africa. It was something called the mRNA Hub, set up in the middle of the pandemic with World Health Organization backing. This laboratory went to Pfizer and Moderna. It said, we need to understand mRNA technology and how it works because it can get us out of COVID, or it can play a part in that anyway. But also mRNA technology potentially could be used for immunization against TB, against malaria. It can be used to deal with HIV and all sorts of cancers. So the theory goes. So, you know, this cannot just be left in the hands of a couple of corporations. We need to understand this. Well, Pfizer and Moderna obviously said, we want nothing to do with that. But the South Africans, they just kind of did it anyway. They cracked it. They worked out how Moderna had done it. And they said, we understand this now. Of course, there's a long way to go between understanding it and actually producing a vaccine. They weren't able to do that in time during COVID, but they are now working on a TB vaccine. And the really revolutionary part of what they've done comes not from their scientific research, but from the fact that they then said, having mastered this, we are going to share it with governments across the world who we think can safely make use of this technology. So they've shared it with 12 other governments, you know, including India, Brazil, Argentina, countries with the ability to scale up this technology, completely outside the intellectual property system. And I think that's really exciting and something we should really be supporting. I also think that in Western countries, we need to make sure that the research that we're already doing, which is so important for the development of medicines, is free of that intellectual property. Why on earth are our tax dollars or pounds going to pay for research which ends up being owned by a multinational corporation? We need to put conditions. I mean, I don't even think this shouldn't be controversial anywhere on the political spectrum, really. We need to put conditions on any research we do, saying this cannot end up simply being produced in a completely unaffordable way by a handful of corporations. We need a different system for how we manage that intellectual property. And I think the final thing I'd say is there has to be some degree of public manufacturing, because at the end of the day, you can do all the research and development you want. If you as a country do not have the ability to get that research, you know, put into a syringe or a pill or whatever and produced at a reasonable cost to your own health system or to your own people, they are going to be able to hold you hostage. And in the most unlikely circumstances, we're seeing a recognition of that now. So you look at the state of California. It has said, because of a monopoly on insulin, so many of our citizens can't afford to deal with their diabetes in a safe way. They're rationing their insulin at great cost to their health, sometimes even the cost of their life. This cannot be right. They've put down $100 million for cost production of insulin that they're going to give to everybody who needs it. And there are seven other states in America following their lead, including states run by Republicans, who are just saying, you know, this system is not sustainable any longer. So I think that you're beginning to see the start of a fundamentally different way of researching, developing and producing medicines, which kind of leaves the pharma industry to one side. Now, that's got to go a lot deeper. It's got to be a lot more transformational than anything we've seen so far. But I think there is at least the possibility now. You know, I was astonished when I woke up one day in August and Biden tweeted, you know, because of getting the Inflation Reduction Act through and beginning to negotiate prices for the first time in America of some medicines, this time we beat Big Pharma. I mean, I never thought I'd see a US president tweet that. And clearly, you know, what he's done is not enough, but it gives us as activists and campaigners an opening that we should do everything that we can to exploit in the years ahead.
Many thanks to Nick Dearden for that introduction to the politics of Big Pharma. His book, Pharmanomics, How Big Pharma Destroys Public Health, is available now from Verso Books. To finish things off, here's another version of Mr. Pharmacist from Mark E. Smith on The Fall. Yeah.